You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, what will it take for students to catch up if they fell behind on learning goals during the pandemic? Find out how schools are trying to bounce back after the worst pandemic years. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about optimism.
Lessons from our parents. How to cook a traditional family meal. How to have compassion. Or how to play an instrument. For Dr. R.F. Ahmed of Madison, his parents taught him about optimism. The writer and cardiologist shares this poem about that lesson.
The Optimist, June 2013, dedicated to my mother Ismat Bano and father Abdul Majid for teaching me optimism. Tough economic times, wars, famine, tsunamis, global meltdown, moral and ethical dehiscence. So is the glass half full or half empty? Enough going on to sap the energies, to drain the enthusiasm. Enough going on to cloud common sense. But wait, it refuses to be a pessimist. It believes in the human will, the human resilience, the human rebound. It believes in the human race to stand up and deliver. Every human being to be counted and ask, how can it better another life? How can it make proud Mother Earth? How can it first do no harm? It is the Good Samaritan. It is the human spirit. It is a dreaming child. The question is, can it become I, we, us yet again?
Dr. R.F. Ahmed shared that writing about optimism, which he wrote in honor of his parents. After recording his poem, he told me a bit more about them.
My mom was a homemaker, and my father was a civil servant. It's interesting, I watched them live optimism. She had cancer, breast cancer, in the 1980s. And it was diagnosed late, and I watched her live her life for years fighting that disease and with great optimism. It never reflected upon me that she was so sick. And then I saw my father as an individual. I think he is the most transformed individual I have seen, who rose from the lowest ranks of civil service and kept educating himself till he reached the highest ranks. I have not seen a transformation that wide in one person in their lifetime. So I saw a lot of optimism in their living, and that rubbed off of me.
So why do you think it's important to be an optimist?
For our present and for our future. Just like my parents were optimistic through their struggles for me, I believe, like the piece talks about, a dreaming child, which is a great example of optimism. And I once was. I also believe that we hurt our better future when our policies as adults hurt the children, be it the wars or famine or disease or gun violence. And I sometimes envy about a world where we can make policies and we can agree to act upon things which are good for the children everywhere.
How do you pass optimism on to your children?
So I say two things. One, I can't control what comes at me, but I can control how I respond to it. And two, I'm a cardiologist. I know what the science says about optimism, and which is it is critical for mental and physical well-being and for fighting disease. There's also another concept, first do no harm. Being a good Samaritan is great, but sometimes the best thing to do is to first do no harm. This is something we live off in our medical world. That is also a point I wanted to bring up.
Dr. R.F. Ahmed is a writer and cardiologist from Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, in most ways, life is pretty much back to normal in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, including the return of in-person schooling for a couple of years now. But many students were affected by the pandemic, and schools are struggling to find ways to recoup years of learning loss related to virtual learning and other challenges. By 2022, the average school district's math score had fallen behind by about half a year. The average student's reading score was about a third of a year behind. That's according to research from Harvard and Stanford universities. And the latest national assessment tests also showed low points in math and reading for 13-year-olds. We're talking about learning loss during the pandemic and how schools around the country are trying to help kids catch up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did virtual learning affect your kids? Are you a student? Do you feel like you're behind? If you work in schools yourself, what kind of things are you seeing among your students? And are there efforts to try to help bridge that gap, to help catch up? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alec McGillis is a reporter at ProPublica, where he covers politics and government. His piece on learning loss appeared in The New Yorker. Alec, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You really zoomed in on a particular public school district in Richmond, Virginia, to illustrate a lot of what a lot of the country is dealing with now. Big picture, what's going on there in Richmond?
Richmond is experiencing learning loss that's even worse than a lot of other parts of the country because they stayed closed especially long. They were closed, entirely closed, for that whole 2021 school year. So their students there did not come back until September of 21, which means that they were out of school buildings for 18 months, and which put them at the far end of the spectrum in how schools responded. So they're dealing there with test scores that have fallen even more than elsewhere, students that are dealing with even more severe kind of social emotional learning issues, lots of issues with violence in the schools. And so they're really recognizing that they're really up against it and have been debating about how they should respond. And there's been a really interesting 2-year-long debate there over what they should do. And what the debate has come down to is whether they should somehow expand the school year, expand the amount of instructional time that students are getting in order to make up some of that lost ground.
And while Richmond may have seen the worst of it in some ways, they're not alone in asking these questions, right? Can you talk a little bit about what we saw nationwide when it came to test scores, learning, social development after school closures?
Nationwide, it's been incredible. You talk to the experts in the field, the education researchers, the economists, and they're kind of stunned by how dire the situation is right now. And it's not really being reflected in the national coverage of this issue, the way we're talking about this. It's to me, it's really one reason I set out to do the story was that it was striking how little attention was going to this, what is really an apocalyptic crisis. I mean, students' livelihoods are going to be affected, you know, for throughout their lifespans, unless there's some more dramatic action taken. In this country, our income, our lifelong earning potential is very closely tied to learning achievement, to skills, even more than in much of the rest of the world. And so the economists warn that these students, this cohort of students and the communities in which they reside, are going to see actual, you know, real hits to their economic livelihood and their, you know, life fulfillment, really, as a result of these really steep drops. And it's not just drops for everyone. That's the key. We're seeing a huge growth in disparities. We had actually managed to close our racial disparities in education somewhat over recent decades. And we've made some real ground in that regard. And all of a sudden now we've just seen those disparities blow wide open again. It's really, really worrisome just how much of a reversal there's been in that regard.
I wanted to ask you more about that, Alec. What was it about virtual learning? Maybe it's obvious people had less or more access to the internet and home resources. What was it about that whole experience that seemed to widen those inequities again?
There are several factors, but that the overriding one that the researchers are now pointing to is that there's a pretty strong correlation between the extent of learning loss, the extent of these drop-offs in learning achievement, this lost ground, and the length of closures, pandemic school closures in various parts of the country. Various states and cities responded in different ways, and the places that kept school buildings closed the longest, stuck with virtual learning the longest, such as Richmond, Virginia, have experienced by and large the steepest drop-offs in achievement. And to the extent that those closures were especially long in our big cities in blue states, where a lot of Black and Hispanic students reside, you are now seeing their numbers suffering accordingly, with especially steep drop-offs. So that really is most likely the biggest reason for this very concerning growth and disparity.
We're talking to ProPublica reporter Alec McGillis about his recent article, Can America's Students Recover What They Lost During the Pandemic? It appeared in The New Yorker. You can see it on the ProPublica website as well. You could join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is this an issue in your school district, in your own family? Did you see your own kid maybe fall behind some during the pandemic when it came to learning? What kind of things are, if any, are helping? If you work in schools, are there things that your district is doing to try to help kids play catch up if they need to? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Coming up, we'll look at some possible solutions, some challenges to solving this. You can join in, and we'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with ProPublica's Alec McGillis about his recent article, Can America's Students Recover What They Lost During the Pandemic? Looking at learning loss during the pandemic, efforts in schools around the country to help kids catch up. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think would most help students and teachers deal with pandemic-related learning loss? What solutions do you see? What are you seeing in your own schools, maybe in your own family? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Alec, earlier you mentioned, Richmond looking at maybe a year-round schooling, other thoughts about ways to expand educational time one way or the other. What kind of solutions are people floating out there for this?
There has been a lot of federal money sent to the schools during and after the pandemic to try to deal with this crisis. In total, about $190 billion has gone to school districts to deal with various aspects of the pandemic fallout. And some of the things that districts are using this money for include intensive tutoring sessions with students, extended day programs, so adding an hour or so at the end of the school day, and some kind of expanded summer school. The challenge has been, the biggest challenge has been that we're suffering a teacher shortage in a lot of districts, and this extends to tutoring. It's really difficult to find people to do this intensive tutoring that's been found to be, if it's done right, found to be quite successful. That's one big challenge. The reason that Richmond and a few other districts have looked at extending the school year calendar is that is a way to address this problem in a way that doesn't require getting more other staff. You basically are using the staff you have. You're simply going to be paying them more to basically teach more days during the school year, and you're taking what we already have in terms of regular school and basically just extending it to try to make up some of that lost ground. And the researchers say that this is probably the most effective way to deal with this huge crisis that we're now facing.
Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kevin is with us in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hey, Rob. All due deference to the guest. As a classroom teacher going through the pandemic, we found out the hard way that so much of teaching is just so face-to-face. It's the personal connection that makes the difference. Also, our curriculum is 2 to 3 years too advanced for what is appropriate childhood developmental levels. talk to people that are 70 years old. The things we learned in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade back then, they're teaching that now in 3rd grade. Why are we pushing kids so hard, so early, so young to succeed where that's where the struggle is? I think if we had more reasonable expectations for what is good for kids at the correct age, we wouldn't see this learning loss. And hey, parents, while we're at it, back up your school, back up your teacher, tell your kids to do their homework and tell them to unplug from their device.
Kevin, could I ask before I let you go, what grade do you teach?
I've been teaching 6th through 8th middle school for about 25 years.
Okay, so you're right in that standardized testing age that's been out there in the news lately. I mean, do you feel like your kids post-pandemic are struggling more than they did pre-pandemic, or not as much change as we're seeing in the news in your classroom?
What I'm seeing is a generation that has totally taken the wrong message from No Child Left Behind. Well, I'm a year older. I don't have to do anything. I get to go to the next grade because you can't leave me behind. We are also holding schools and teachers accountable to 12-year-olds who are not invested in necessarily showing us all that they can do.
Gotcha. Kevin, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there, Alec. First of all, I mean, I don't think you'd argue with his point about face-to-face teaching being more valuable, but the higher expectations he sees out there for current students. What do you think?
Well, what really struck me in the caller's comments was his mention of the devices, and that's something I'm hearing about from so many teachers now, the challenge that's presented by, particularly by phones in the classroom and students being distracted by them, and that's just becoming a huge issue. And it's actually something that people point to when they note that we did see pre-pandemic, we started to see a flattening of scores of our, we had seen general growth in scores over the decades, and then we saw a definite flattening starting, and even some dips starting around, 2010, 11, 12, 13, 14, in that period. And there's been some surmising that is connected to the invasion of the classroom by just device distraction. As far as the higher standards, I can certainly see the caller's point. There's also, at the same time, there's been an interesting shift in the debate around standards, where when you raise this issue now of the pandemic learning loss, you are definitely seeing some of a sort of rhetorical move, especially kind of on the left, among progressive Americans, to kind of actually questioning the whole notion of standards. This notion that standardized tests are biased. We should not be basing too much on standardized tests. Students are learning in other ways that don't show up in standardized tests. And there's definitely been somewhat of a general shakiness of assumptions around standardized testing and how should learning be assessed and scored, and that's actually kind of made it somewhat hard to now muster real alarm around this huge pandemic learning loss, because even before the pandemic there was starting to be somewhat of a move away from the expectations and standards that we had kind of built up around standardized testing. And that really, I think, is one reason we're not seeing as much urgency as we probably should be around this current crisis.
Kevin, thanks for the call. We'll go to Kate now in Platteville. Kate, hi.
Hi. I feel like the previous call just kind of started to bring some of my question, started to speak to some of my question, and that is, how confident are we that these issues really are corollary with the pandemic? Or if what we really should be looking at is, while the pandemic certainly didn't help the situation, should we be looking at some other pretty major causes of these learning declines?
Kate, I got you. We don't have a lot of time left. Alec, what do you think?
There are other issues out there, including the social the the cell phones in classroom one that I just mentioned, but it's pretty clear when you look at the numbers that we've suffered incredibly dramatic drop-offs that correlate exactly with the year plus of closures in a lot of districts around the country. And so there just clearly was just a massive declines tied to the lack of in-person instructional time, all that time that students lost. And the question is how to now make that up.
Okay, thanks for the call. Just in our last minute, Alec, you mentioned it seems like there's some ways we're pretty sure to help these kids. They involve more time. They involve teachers who may not exist because of a teacher shortage. Are you seeing efforts that can overcome that challenge and give these kids the extra instructional time they might need?
Yes. I mean, what I found inspiring was in Richmond that there were a couple schools that now are going to be starting a month early this summer. They got the approval for a pilot program there. That the effort to do this district-wide fell apart for reasons that I described in the piece, a lot of resistance from various quarters in town. But at these couple schools, elementary schools, they're going to be starting on July 24th this month, a month early, schools that fell especially far behind with a lot of disadvantaged students. And it's going to be really interesting to see what these schools are able to do with that extra time to make up that lost ground.
Alec, thanks a lot for sharing your reporting with us today.
Thank you.
That's Alec McGillis, reporter at ProPublica, where he covers politics and government. He talked to us about his recent reporting on pandemic-related learning loss. You can read more. We'll get a link to his article up at wpr.org/centraltime. Researchers announced two major discoveries last week in the world of physics, and Wisconsin scientists were at the center of both. We'll talk to two of those scientists about what they observed, starting with gravitational waves. After gathering more than 15 years' worth of data, scientists at the North American Nanohertz Observatory for Gravitational Waves, or NanoGrav, announced new evidence of low-frequency gravitational waves that ripple through the fabric of space and time. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Now, have you been following this story since it came out in the news? Is there something you're curious about, confused about as to what this all means? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Sarah Vigeland is an assistant professor of physics at UW-Milwaukee. She's also chair of the Gravitational Wave Detection Working Group at NanoGrav. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the basics. What are gravitational waves?
Gravitational waves are ripples in space and time that are produced when massive things move. Now, you and I are much too small to create gravitational waves that could be observed using any means that we know of. But gravitational waves are produced by really, really massive things like black holes. And that's really useful for astronomers because black holes, well, they're black. They don't emit light, so they're hard to see using conventional telescopes. But when they move, they give off these ripples. And by observing them, you can use those waves to figure out things about the sources that generated them. Things like how far away are they? How massive are they? How fast are they moving?
The thing I have a hard time wrapping my head around is what exactly is waving? And I think it's space itself? What's going on?
That's exactly it. So if you think about, so in general relativity, massive objects deform space and time, they warp it. And then if that massive object moves, the way that space is deformed has to change. And the information about that change is kind of spreading out throughout the universe, okay, in the form of these gravitational waves.
Now, talk us through how NanoGrav detected these particular gravitational waves. This is not something we can detect with the naked eye or anything like that. What went into this?
Right. So we've basically created a galaxy-scale gravitational wave detector, and it's because the galaxy is filled with these special kinds of stars called pulsars, and pulsars act like clocks just sitting out in space, ticking away. And that makes them ideal for measuring changes in space and time. Okay, so we monitor these pulsars. And by monitoring them, we can detect very tiny changes in space and time, which are produced by gravitational waves. So in essence, we have a gravitational wave detector that spread throughout our galaxy. And then we use that to see gravitational waves coming from distant galaxies, coming from, for example, two black holes orbiting one another in a distant galaxy.
We've seen some past discoveries of gravitational waves, higher frequency ones. Can you tell us what those were versus what's involved in this new discovery, these lower frequency waves?
Sure. So the first gravitational wave detections was made in 2015 by the LIGO experiments. They use lasers to detect high frequency gravitational waves. So those are gravitational waves created by things that are changing on timescales of seconds. Okay, so in the case of LIGO, they detected two black holes about the same mass as our sun crashing into each other. So this is a kind of sudden event where space-time is changing very suddenly, but then it's over after the collision, after the merger happens. Okay, what we're seeing is a completely different type of source. What we think we're seeing is coming from two supermassive black holes. So black holes, millions or billions of times the mass of our sun, orbiting one another. And they're orbiting relatively slowly. They're orbiting maybe once every 10 years, 50 years, something like that. And so space-time is changing, but on very long timescales. Because of that, LIGO can't see the gravitational waves that we see. And conversely, we can't see the kind that they see. The experiments are really very complementary in the same way that optical telescopes and radio telescopes are complementary. They both look at light, but they look at different kinds of light.
Talking to Sarah Vigeland, physicist at UW-Milwaukee, chair of the Gravitational Wave Detection Working Group at NanoGrav. You may have heard about a couple big physics discoveries last week. This is one of them, these low-frequency gravitational waves. Sarah, now you've found these low frequency waves. In turn, what does that start to tell us about, I guess, not just our galaxy, but about the universe?
Well, this is really exciting for us. We're just at the beginning of this story. We are just starting to see evidence of gravitational waves. But there's still a lot of questions that we have about, you know, the nature of this signal and what kind of source is producing it. So I mentioned supermassive black holes, but that's just one theory for what could be producing them. There are lots of other theories. That's part of why we're doing this experiment. That's why we're making these measurements, so that we can learn what actually is out there emitting these low frequency gravitational waves. A lot of these sources that we're excited about are things that either we can't see through electromagnetic observations, or, you know, we can, but it's difficult. And if we are able to use gravitational waves and electromagnetic observations, that will give us even more information.
You mentioned general relativity earlier, one of Einstein's, one of his big ideas. How does this discovery and the previous discovery of gravitational waves fit into confirming what he had proven, I guess, mathematically, 100 plus years ago?
Gravitational waves are a really important prediction of general relativity. So just the fact that we're able to observe them directly is an important test. But they also let us study gravity itself in a lot of detail. So gravitational waves in general relativity have two polarizations. You know, you might be familiar with the idea that light is polarized, like you might have polarized sunglasses that let through some of the light, but they block other light. Gravitational waves also come in two polarizations in general relativity, but in other theories of gravity, there might be extra polarizations. So that's a really important test that we can do with these gravitational wave detectors. We can go out and look and see if there is any evidence of extra polarizations. If there is, that would be a groundbreaking discovery. If not, that lets us put limits on how far away the theory of gravity can be from general relativity.
100 years in the making in some ways, 15 years of data collection led to this point for NanoGrav. What comes next?
A lot more. We have a lot of other gravitational wave searches we want to do with this data set. I mean, this data set, we've already done a lot of analyses on it, but we have even more to do, searching for different types of gravitational wave sources. And the thing that I'm most excited about is working with our international collaborators. So At the same time, we had gravitational wave results published by the European Pulsar Timing Array, the Indian Pulsar Timing Array, the Parkes Pulsar Timing Array, and the Chinese Pulsar Timing Array. And NanoGrav and its international collaborators are going to be creating a combined data set where we take all of our data and make one giant data set, and then we're going to search that for gravitational waves. That will allow us to get even better measurements of this signal.
What's been the most exciting part of this process for you?
It's just incredibly exciting to be doing something that's never been done before, really on the frontier of science, you know, opening this new window on the universe. I'm really excited to see what we actually find.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your research with us.
Thank you.
Sarah Vigeland is an assistant professor of physics at UW-Milwaukee. She's chair of the Gravitational Wave Detection Working Group at NanoGrav. She joined us to talk about NanoGrav's recent announcement about low-frequency gravitational waves that ripple through, you know, the fabric of space. Up next, we'll be hearing from another Wisconsin scientist about another big discovery, this one from our own Milky Way galaxy. That's coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation on recent discoveries in physics. Last week, scientists at UW-Madison's Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory announced they detected subatomic ghost particles coming from within our own galaxy. A Wisconsin physicist joins us now for a look at that discovery, what it means for the future of astrophysics. You could join in if you've been following the progress of Ice Cube and the search for neutrinos at 800-642-1234. Join in with your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Jim Madsen is interim director of the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center at UW-Madison. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks, Rob.
Let's start again with the basics here. Neutrinos, what are they?
Yeah, so neutrinos are fundamental particles, which means they don't have any inner bits, and they are produced when other particles change identities. So it could be, for example, radioactive decay.
And I mentioned they're sometimes called ghost particles. These are hard to find. Can you talk about the challenge of detecting neutrinos in the first place?
Yeah, so it's one of these strange things where the issue isn't that there's not enough of them. It's the issue is that they're essentially invisible. So they go streaming right through easier than light can go through glass. So you have to be very clever and build giant detectors in order to catch a few of them.
And that takes us to Ice Cube in Antarctica. Can you tell us how you hunt for neutrinos down there?
Yeah, so what we need is a large chunk of clear material, and that's both to have something for the neutrino to bump into, and then once it bumps into that, to create other particles that are visible. And so the first people who tried to do this were working in water, either deep in oceans or seas or in Lake Baikal in Russia. But in 1987, Francis Hollison got the idea, maybe you could put light sensors down in the ice and that would work even better. And so surprisingly, it turned out to be right. And we're the only detector that's big enough to explore space in this way.
That takes us to the new announcement. Now, I've talked to people from Ice Cube before about detecting neutrinos, long-distance neutrinos from outside our galaxy. Well, here we are. The call is coming from inside the Milky Way. What did we find here?
Yeah, so the kind of unexpected thing from when we first came up with the idea to build this is that we wouldn't see our galaxy as one of the first objects because it's the closest, right? And so what we've did is come up with a clever way to sort out all the competing signals we are seeing in order to make our neighborhood visible. So kind of like, trying to mask out sounds when you're at a party so that you can hear the person that's standing next to you talking.
Now, when we're talking about neutrinos, now, of course, when we think of light, it travels at the speed of light. So we know how long it takes to get from point A to point B. How fast are these neutrinos going?
Yeah, so these neutrinos are essentially going at the speed of light. They have a small amount of mass, so they can't quite get to exactly the speed of light, but they have such high energy that to a good approximation saying that they are going at the speed of light is pretty close.
Now, when,
in a race, they would lose, but just by a small amount of light.
When you detect neutrinos, whether from Milky Way galaxy or beyond, what is creating them? What are the things out there that are setting them shooting our way?
So that's kind of the neat part of the story is that's our next question we want to answer. And amazingly, even though we've been studying the galaxy with many different types of telescopes, the very high energy aspects of it are still unknown. So I wish I could tell you that answer, but you know, one likely type of source would be left over from a star exploding, like which is called a supernova remnant. So, but the amazing thing is we still don't know.
We're talking to Jim Madsen, interim director of the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center at UW-Madison, looking at their recent discovery, neutrinos. They've spotted those before in this research station in Antarctica. Now they're finding them within our own Milky Way galaxy. Jim, are we at a point where we could say the Milky Way galaxy produces fewer neutrinos than its sister and brother galaxies out there in the universe?
Francis Halsland likes to say it's a neutrino desert. So it turns out it's not as prolific as the other galaxies. And that's one of the intriguing questions. Why? What makes it different? And that tells us something about either the types of sources that are in our galaxy or maybe about the environment around the central black hole in our galaxy. There's something that's fundamentally different that makes it produce fewer neutrinos than, say, this one that we discovered last fall. That's millions of light years away, but easier to find than our own neighborhood.
What you've started to touch on this a little bit already. What are we hoping to learn now by studying neutrinos and those from Milky Way, the Milky Way galaxy, versus those from elsewhere? What are some of the questions you're hoping to start answering?
Yeah, so the amazing thing is nature has figured out a way to accelerate particles to a billion times more energy than the best laboratories we've built on Earth. And we have no idea how that happens or even aside from a few places that we've discovered now with IceCube, where that's happening. So one of the things we want to do is understand that, and that may open up totally new ideas of physics. And then what's neat about IceCube is it actually has multiple things it studies at the same time. So the neutrinos themselves are still not well understood, and they do amazing things like they have three types of neutrinos, and they can be created as one type, but show up as another. And so the only particles we know that can do that. So we're trying to understand not only these amazing sources out in space, but also the properties of this neutrinos that tell us about those objects.
I want to talk about the challenges of doing this kind of work, right? Detecting these incredibly difficult to detect particles and maintaining a research station basically at the South Pole, right, deep into Antarctica. What are some of the challenges of doing high-tech research in this incredibly remote and inhospitable location?
Yeah, it's, so it starts with good design of the experiment, you know. So all the instruments that were put down on the ice have to function flawlessly in order for the experiment to work, and they have to keep working. And so the neat thing is some of these Detectors now have been in the ice for close to 20 years, and still, as Francis says, tick like a Swiss watch. And so the other big challenge is the station is only open for about 3 months of the year. So we actually hire two people each year to spend 13 months at the South Pole.
Wow.
If something does break on the surface, like, for example, once in a while, one of the computer hard drives will crash or something like that, they can repair that. But the good news is that it's mostly super robust and working extremely well. The facility is collecting data at 99.5% of the time. So it's been a tremendous success.
Back to neutrinos themselves. As I understand it, I mean, we're constantly, right, awash with neutrinos. There are lots of them, I don't know, probably passing through me right now without any indication that they've been there. Do I have that right when it comes to their abundance and the way they don't interact with most of what they go through?
Yeah, that's right. One of the crazy facts that I like to tell people is you have 100 trillion neutrinos going through your body every second. And in your lifetime, you might capture one. So if you had ideas of being a neutrino experiment, you're no good, right?
And just in our last few moments, Jim, what is next? What are some of the next questions you're hoping to answer with Ice Cube?
Yeah, so the next steps are to better understand where these neutrinos are being produced in our galaxy. So right now, if you've seen the images, that map's pretty fuzzy, but we have some ideas on how to sharpen that up. We have some other galaxies that we think we'll be able to resolve soon. And then, as I said, studying the fundamental properties of the neutrinos themselves is a big part of our mission now. So we're going to have insights into how these neutrinos change from one type to the other and what that tells us about the way the universe works.
Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Rob.
That's Jim Madsen, interim director of the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center at the UW-Madison. He talked to us about the subatomic ghost particles originating from within our own Milky Way galaxy. That discovery just announced last week. One of two stories we've talked about with Wisconsin researchers about fundamental properties of our universe. Some mind-blowing stuff.